Reading from The Pirates by George MacDonald Fraser, Chapter the 13th. The reaction of anyone finding £2 million in gold coin at the back of a garage or in an old chest of drawers is normally, "Hell's bells, Doris, will you come and look at this?" And when they have gaped greedily and babbled of Rolls-Royces and villas at Marbella, and brewed a cup of tea to calm their excitement, then realization dawns. Can't spend it at the shops. The stock market is too dicey. And aren't there laws about treasure trove and capital gains tax and currency restrictions and other evil wheezes whereby greedy civil servants rob the deserving of their windfalls? To say nothing of the risk of being mugged, probably by their neighbours. Indeed, and it was just as bad in the 17th century, which is why pirates, who were always acquiring heaps of the ready, invariably ended up burying the stuff in some godforsaken spot. It was simply the only safe thing to do. Sack a city, loot a galleon, scuttle a plate fleet, it made no odds. Like it or not, the end of the day found them hacking great holes in desert islands, weeping with frustration with their socks full of sand. Happy Dan's mob were no exception when they saw the pile of specie into which blood had inadvertently stumbled, and realized it must have been mislaid by some previous owner of the frantic frog. They had their customary rave and gloat, Or les oodles more bleu, nous sommes riches, ah, Saint-Tropez, here we come. But they knew it was just window dressing, and that the stuff would eventually have to be rowed ashore in neat parcels clearly marked, and shoved underground as usual, avec comme malédiction. So it is a familiar scene that meets our eyes, the blue and sun-kissed sea gently creaming a golden strand of the mane, the frantic frog riding at anchor, the raffish figures of the buccaneers delving a great pit in the sand just below high water mark, Happy Dan Pugh, now fully restored, sitting on a cask with a feather in his hat, exclaiming, "Ah, les buckets et spades pour faisant les châteaux de plage! Où sont les souliers bains de mer de Marcel, les gym shoes et les donkey rides?" Vanity, all distraught in her maroon velvet between two hairy sentinels, and Blood, with his hands pinioned, being lowered into the pit above the treasure and buried up to the neck. That's the picture, but we're not the only ones watching, by the powers. From the dense jungle fringing the beach, unseen midst the foliage, fierce black eyes glare and sharp ears catch the distant sound of the pirates' voices and the shrill protests of the victim. "Haven't ye any gratitude, you foul frogs?" he was demanding as they shoveled in the last spadefuls and tramped it down nice and tight under his chin. "If it hadn't been for me, divil a doubloon would ye have seen. Pew, you muckrake, give me a sword and I'll cut your dirty soul out. Or better still, let's toss for it, eh? Heads, you turn me loose. Tails?" "Oui," said Happy Dan, interested. "Tails?" "We can discuss that later," cried Blood desperately. "Be a sport, man. Is this fit end for an officer and gentleman? You know it isn't. And it's unnecessary. What's the point? You could maroon me just as easy." "Some fun that, par exemple," scoffed Happy Dan. "This way, foolish Mick. The tide approaches itself slowly. First one wave over your head, then another and another, until glug, 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 adieu. C'est artistique, non? And the bones of your squelette, they mark the place where the ouf est enterré parfaitement." The pirate crew applauded with fiendish glee and watched as the first wave of the incoming tide broke against Blood's chin and retreated hissing over the wet sand. Then another wave, which splashed his face, and a third which broke clean over his head, leaving him spluttering. Vanity could endure no more. "Ah, of your pity, fell and cruel men!" she cried. "Can't you shoot him, or hang him, or knock him on the head, or something?" "Do us a favor!" roared Blood, spitting sea-water. "Captain Pugh, this is beastly!" cried Vanity, and proudly faced the foppish filibuster. "Unless you release that man immediately, you shall never have me to wife. Not that you will, anyway, but that's beside the point. I shall knock off food and grow thin and unattractive. Furthermore, I shall mock your rotten French pronunciation and recite petit poir until my mouth meets at the back, and—" What effect these dire threats would have had, we'll never know. For at that moment an uncanny, wailing cry sounded in the depths of the jungle, and an eerie silence fell over the sunlit beach, broken only by Blood's snorts and cries of "Jesus!" All gazed about them in wonder, and suddenly something sang in the air like a great wasp, and Happy Dan staggered back, plucking at a feathered shaft, quivering in his arm, and ruining his cuff. With oaths and yells, the pirates sprang to their muskets as a positive hail of arrows came winging from the trees, followed by the shrill war whoops of lithe, half-naked brown figures breaking from the ambush, feathers in their hair and faces grotesquely daubed with paint. "Indiens, les sauvages rouges!" cried the startled pirates. "Ah, je suis blessé dans le bras!" gasped Happy Dan. "Serve you right, and I hope it hurts," snapped Vanity. "Whoop, whoop," shrieked the Indians, charging home. "Fetch a shovel, for God's sake," roared Blood, his head awash. Further conversation was lost in the din of battle as pirate closed with Indian, muskets banged, arrows hissed, cutlasses and spears clashed. Vanity stamped in vexation, Blood gurked and gargled, and on both sides men fell wounded and, in extreme cases, dead. Judging the combat with the eye of one who has cheered on countless boyfriends in rugby scrums, Vanity decided that Blood would probably drown before half-time, and gallant girl that she was, heedless of the foam that threatened to damp her pumps and ruin her silk hose, she knelt and began to scoop out a hollow round his head, on the theory that the water level would drop. It didn't. "Give us the kiss of life," spluttered the colonel. "Really," exclaimed Vanity, scooping away, "don't you ever stop getting fresh?" "Oxygen," gasped Blood weakly. "Fill thy lungs and breathe into me mouth, Acushla, so shall I draw life-giving air from thy sweet lips." "And if I don't," he thought ardently, "what a lovely way to go." "Oh, I see," said Vanity, frowning. "A bit kinky, is it not? Still, here goes." She gulped air, locked onto the colonel just as he submerged, and tried to imagine he was a Christmas balloon. She went under a brunette and came out a breathless blonde, and Happy Dan, pausing in his pistoling, clutched his pallid brow. "Dieu caillou les corbeaux!" he cried aghast. "Regardez sa chevelure! She has flipped her wig! What do I see, me? Un moment, ma belle brune. Le next un bébé peroxide. C'est trop fort. A moi, garçon, it's all going wrong. Tous les bateaux!" Seeing their leader quail, the filibusters lost no time in legging it for the boats and rowing hastily for the frantic frog, with Pugh babbling weakly in the stern sheets. The Indians, nightmare figures in their paint and gold ornaments, were left in possession of the beach, where, having cut the throats of the enemy wounded with quartz knives and danced the Hawaiian war chant to bongo accompaniment, they gathered round the interesting spectacle of a sodden blonde in maroon velvet, apparently trying to eat the head of a white man under 2 feet of water. Vanity, half-drowned herself, was aware of their strange guttural grunts, which, although she knew it not, meant, "Man, these honkies! Hey, coodle-poodle! What's this chick trying to do, you reckon?"
"Don't look at me, Patzel-cut-moon! Maybe she's a priestess worshipping the great white god from the east. But if that's him, brother, he's wet. How about that? Think we ought to dig him up and take him back to Cohocklesen? Why not? He's going to look real lousy sticking out the beach when the tide goes back. Okay, men, dig-a-dig-dig.
Thus it was that as the frantic frog weighed anchor, with Happy Dan sniffing, smelling salts, and weeping, while the crew read him Marcel et Denise à la Cirque to soothe him, a weird barbaric procession was winding its way deep into the tropic jungle. Dreadful warriors with filed teeth and fiery black eyes chanted the blood-chilling song of the great white god and the damp blonde discovered naked underwater. Their bone whistles shrilled and their war drums boomed in melancholy cadence as they filed down the jungle trail. The westering sun gleamed on their quartz blades, gaudy plumage and gold bangles, and on the fair head of the lovely captive, born in a bamboo cage by stalwart savages, her nylons hung on the bars to dry. Last of all came a pathetic sight, the great white god himself slung helpless from a pole, leaking salt water at every step. Ah, pity their plight, reader, as they are carried ever deeper into the steamy forest swamps, for their destination is the dread lost city of Cohocklesen, long sought by conquistadores for its fabled wealth of gold, high-grade drinking chocolate, and native art so revoltingly ugly that later generations of settlers would revere it as work of genius. In fact, the Cohocklesens were just rotten sculptors, and their unimagined ferocity stemmed directly from the frustration they suffered in their continual failures to design the wheel, which they attempted by carving enormous lumps of rock, none of which would ever roll properly, whereon they were piled up in gigantic step pyramids, which the Cohocklesens defiantly described as temples, but which everyone knew were just industrial pollution. So this unhappy people waited bad-temperedly for a great white god who, legend had it, would give them wheels that worked. In the meantime, they put by the time in sun worship, cannibalism, human sacrifice, and orgies on drinking chocolate, which made them sick and worse-tempered than ever. What hideous fate awaits vanity and blood at the hands of these cruel and unartistic primitives? Let's find out, as the procession debouches from the jungle into a valley where step pyramids loom skyward on every hand, their summits wreathed in mists. In the central stone-flagged plaza, a rumble with the sound of discarded wheel prototypes being dragged away by panting slaves, a discontented crowd of semi-clad barbarians waited as the prisoners were dragged before the stone dais on which stood Brasso, cacique of the tribe, a hawk-nosed elder with folded arms, wrapped in imperturbable dignity, and a cloak of frog fur. His agate eyes flashed cruelly at Vanity, proudly erect in her off-the-shoulder maroon velvet, and Blood, who looked like an unsuccessful beachcomber. Brasso, with stately flowing gestures, addressed their captors in incomprehensible grunts.
"Great white god, my ass," was what they meant. "I ask you, Patzelkuntlen, do he have wheels? He don't. Fact, man, I ain't seen such a unwheeled cat since Papa Caterpillar erupted. He looks like you dug him up someplace."
"Right on, chief," said Patzelkuntlen. "We dug him, yes, sir. But if you can't use him, how about the chick?"
"How the hell do I know?" cried Brasso peevishly. He drew himself up and proclaimed, "Let the Princess of the Sun decide!"
At this there was a great clashing of brazen gongs and a solemn chanting of hidden choirs as the watching thousands prostrated themselves in the dust with moans of awe.
Brasso shielded his eyes. A fanfare of horns sounded, and at the head of the temple steps, behind the dais, the Princess of the Sun made an entrance worthy of a biblical epic, preceded by maidens in gauzy skirts, who swept the steps with golden fronds and sprinkled disinfectant, came a massive litter of solid gold, borne by muscular myrmidons, and in it, stoned out of her tiny mind on drinking chocolate, sat a bronzed glamazon, who looked like Paramount's idea of Tiger Lily. Superbly tall and queenly, with tawny features classical enough to advertise taboo perfume, she was resplendent in a split conga skirt of bird-in-paradise feathers and of gold, as Vanity noted wide-eyed, were her sandals, girdle, bra, and bangles, while precious gems glittered in her towering headdress of plumes and tropical fruit. Well, you didn't expect her in clogs and shawl. Moving in an exotic rumba rhythm to which the princess dazedly tried to keep time with a fan of beaten gold, the myrmidons bore her to the dais, and there she bent her sultry, slightly vacant eyes on the captives, while Brasso explained,
"The male cat's white, okay?
But princess, the great white god, he ain't. No wheels, right? So zilch. But with the chick, there's alternatives. You need a handmaiden, manicurist, temple receptionist. Just say the word, princess. Or we can dish her up with yams, I mean, and pineapple rings at the next barbecue, just the way you like it. Speak, divine daughter of the sun." The princess sniffed a delicate blast of chocolate dust, shuddered, placed an unsteady, slender finger neath languid chin, and tried to focus on Vanity. "Oh, man," she thought, "any minute I'm going to crash, but not in public, please, dear God, or these yokels may discover I'm a runaway nun from Campeche, who's exchanged one habit for another. Oh, steady, girl, easy does it. You're the Princess of the Sun, right?" She focused at last, and her eyes narrowed cruelly as she considered Vanity. "Nice threads," she thought, "but I need you round the temple like a hole in the head. You're the kind who'd seduce my pusher and set me up for a bust." Blood looked cute, she thought, but he wasn't the great white god, so what the hell? Controlling an urge to do tail spins over the valley, the princess spoke in a vibrant contralto. "Man, death, by Magwe, ugh." She knew how to talk like a jungle denizen if no one else in Kohakal Guzlan did. "Woman, human sacrifice, ugh. Make sun god glad, ugh." "Hot damn!" Brasso snapped his fingers in admiration. "Why didn't I think of that? Okay, cats, you heard the princess. One magwe, one for the altar. Let's move it. See, divine princess, your people..." Uh-oh, she's gone into a trance again. Poor kid, this divinity bit is killing her. And sure enough, the princess had collapsed with a deep groan of, "Oh, God!" and lay twitching and glassy-eyed as her litter was borne up the temple steps and out of sight of the vulgar gaze. Brasso made imperious gestures, and Vanity and Blood found themselves surrounded by excited, tooth-gnashing savages who swept them away, struggling in opposite directions.
"You say I was hit by falling masonry," exclaimed Captain Avery, rubbing his slender but muscular neck. "Nay, 'tis passing strange, for yon dungeon seemed admirably designed and stoutly built, such as would hardly shed lumps on its occupants."
"What does it matter?" husked Black Sheba. "We are here, alone in the depths of the jungle, thou and I, a man and a woman, here in this tropic paradise of perfumed blooms and succulent fruits, alone, as in a very garden of love like Adam and Eve." and she slithered sinuously towards him, her hand brushing his cheek.
"Adam and the serpent were more like it."
Avery's words dropped like ice cubes. "'Tis my belief ye had me clobbered, that I might not rescue yon poor Spanish lady."
"That puling twerp," sneered Sheba. "I marked her not. Ah, barracuda mio, what can I think on but that you dared all to save me again, and that we are free, you and I, and may fly together where we will, I to the world's end and beyond, in each other's arms?"
She did another slither and embraced his knees, crooning contentedly.
"Oh, pack it in," said Avery. "I enlarged thee because I'm shot if I'll leave anyone, however depraved, to the devildoms of Spain. But know that I propose to deliver thee to British justice as soon as I have tooled back to Cartagena and abstracted Donna Mellifluo."
"Has that clock on sconce disordered thee? Tool back? With Don Lardo's soldiers already in pursuit, for I marked the gleam of their arms behind when our canoe foundered at dawn, and thou a swoon, so that I must bear thee afoot in my arms, and in these heels too, and so brought thee to this glade and nursed thee, and soothed thy brow with cooling water, and massaged thy poor hurt."
Her voice dropped to a murmur, and her fingers strayed on his arm.
"Zounds! You've got smashing muscles, and the cutest little mole on your chest. I kissed it as you slept, all unaware."
"Of all the crust!"
Avery's cheek glowed like middle-cut salmon.
"Have you no shame?" "No, of course you haven't."
He took a big breath.
"What's the use? I thank you for your efforts. But now restored, I must return for Donna Mellifluo."
"Ah! Cospetto!"
Sheba leaped up and raged to and forth in the remnants of her white trouser suit.
"Has she bewitched thee, the Spanish punk? Fiend take her, I could rake her sheep's eyes out."
She whirled like an infuriated Lena Horn.
"And what of thy darling vanity, then, thy English milk pudding?"
"For your information," quo Avery icily, "my fiancé awaits me in care of my trusted agent."
That's what he thinks, poor sap.
"And we shall be reunited and spliced as soon as I have rescued Donna Mellifluo, consigned thee to the coop, and mopped up the rest of your associates. Where is Bilbo, by the way, and that other brute who doesn't shave?"
"Who can say?" murmured Sheba evilly. "Hunting thee, perchance. There's little gratitude in him, my captain, or in Firebeard, so why not make the most of what's in me?"
She undulated towards him, hands on hips, and then, creature of impulse that she was, hurled herself on him and knocked him flat on his back, smothering him with hot kisses.
"Ah, barracuda, come to my black castle on storm-lashed Octopus Rock," she panted. "I promise I'll get rid of my Swedes and beach boys and love none but thee. Shalt lie soft and feed a dainties and go surfing and scuba diving and have captive commanders to wait on thee and press thee new silk cravats daily, or we shall cruise to the Indies and put the pleasure resorts to sack and pillage. Casinos aflame, merchant bankers sold into slavery, the spoil of palaces and supermarkets to drip through our fingers. Oh, we shall rule the world together and—"
"Do you mind?" said Avery coldly. "The grass is damp and you're no flyweight, so if you'll please to remove—"
"I don't believe it," Sheba ground her teeth. "Art insensate? Art immune to love?"
"Certainly not," said Avery, brushing himself down. "Mummy loved me, and Aunt Prue, and Golightly, my nanny."
Sheba gnashed and clutched her temples.
"God's blood! I mean love!"
"I'd rather not discuss it," said Avery,
rising and shrugging his splendid shoulders in a way which made her feel all faint.
"Now,
I must determine our precise whereabouts in this trackless jungle, and then—" He stiffens suddenly, his face alight with intelligent inquiry. "Hist! What was that?" Sheba was on her feet, every nerve a quiver. All around was deathly still, save for the roar of the river, the scream of parakeets and chatter of monkeys in the green, the hum of insects and the snuffle of tapirs rooting for truffles. And yet her perfect ears quivered. "Odd's guts!" she hissed. "'Tis a human voice, I in dire torment, a far distant wordless scream of agony."
"But with an Irish accent," breathed Avery. "We are in South America, aren't we?"
"Can Dunlardo's soldiery be practicing on some hapless prisoner?" gasped Sheba. "Nay, or fiendish Indians trying out their poisoned darts. Whatever on it, we had best away."
"What, and leave some poor soul, from Belfast, unless I'm mistaken, to perish by inches? Not a chance." Avery's jaw creaked with resolution. "Here, you take the sword."
"But you, peerless master of the rapier, ye are. 'Twere best you had it."
"You forget. I have my bare hands," said Avery calmly, and slipped into the undergrowth with an athletic smoothness that would have made Nureyev look like a shambling drunk. Sheba followed, half dazed with worship. What a demigod was this! If only he didn't get these Boy Scout impulses! But she'd educate him, one of these days, when she'd got him to Octopus Rock and thrown away the key. Through the dense jungle they stole, Sheba marveling at the tall Englishman's uncanny woodcraft. No twigs cracked neath his feet, and his sensitive fingers brushed aside creepers, rotten logs, and snakes with never a rustle. Even when he fell in swamps, it was with minimum splash, and lovely mover though she was, it was all that the pirate queen could do to stay hard on his heels. For what seemed like, and in fact was, hours, they crept on, guided by the piteous Hibernian cries, which sounded nearer and nearer, until, wriggling noiselessly through a canebrake, they found themselves on the edge of a clearing in which they discerned two figures, one sitting, one hanging, and complaining bitterly. Colonel Blood had had another shocking day, and the coming night didn't look like being much better. He was spread-eagled, face down from four posts, his torso about 3 feet off the floor, the favored position for those condemned to death by Magway, or Percy Thrower's Revenge, as it has been loosely called. Beneath Blood, and pointing directly at his navel, a slender, innocent-looking green shoot was growing from the soil. This was the dreaded Magway, which grows, thanks to the tropic clime and the grow-bags with which the devilish savages are wont to tend it, at a rate of 3 feet per day. And since its point is wondrous strong and razor-keen, it pierces anything that gets in its way, like an Irish abdomen, for instance. But it had already grown 2 feet while Blood watched it, bug-eyed, and he could see no way of avoiding appalling indigestion unless he could prevail on his solitary guard. This guard was a stranger to Blood, but if you have trod the paths of romantic fiction, you'll recognize the type. He was called Solomon Shafto, and he was one of those eccentric seamen who were forever falling into the hands of the Inquisition and failing to satisfy the examiners on religious grounds. Wherefore, he had endured diverse torments, do you see, and languished in the dungeons of the Holy Office until he escaped, since when he had been wandering dimly in the jungle, befriending birds, eating berries, and removing thorns from the feet of Indian caciques who had adopted him, sort of. None too bright to start with, Solomon had been intellectually reduced by his ordeals, to the point where he was fit for little but political economy and rough gardening, and since courses in the former were not available in Cohackelgizlin, they had put him in charge of weeds.
He was old, skinny, dirt-tanned, and incredibly bright-eyed. It need hardly be added that he wore ragged skins, had white hair growing to his waist, and cackled a good deal. Blood couldn't get through to him at all.
"Prune the maguey plant, says he to me," Solomon was exclaiming beadily, scratching his rags. "Nay, maister, us couldn't do that, not nohow. It's not been prunin' time, says I to thee. Prune in March, mulch in May, pot in August, hey, hey, hey," he chanted and added, "and derry down do where voodle dee oi doi vout.
Then stick a cane in the ground and train the damned thing so that it grows past me," implored Blood. "Look, if it continues on its present course, it'll get all messy and yug."
"Whoop-dee-doo!"
exclaimed Solomon, shaking unkempt locks.
"Us couldn't do that, maister, on account it might stunt its growth, looky. Ay, as happened to Widow Splurge's cowcumber back in Babbicum when I wore a lad. Ay, them were the days with October apples and crusty bread when drippin' were only 3 farthings a firkin, I mind. Ay, all stunted with a widow's cowcumber."
"I'll be bloody well stunted if you don't help me," cried Blood. "Look, why not cut me loose? Then shall thy infernal plant suffer no whit."
"Injuns wouldn't like it," said Solomon, dancing crazily in agitation. "Look arter him, Saul," says they to me. "Go easy with the watering can and baby bio, and when the maguey point be a ticklin' of his belly, do he come tell us, and we'll all sit round and enjoy the good bit. Dig a dagger foot foot, dig a dagger foot."
Blood groaned with despair, heaving helplessly in his bonds, watching the maguey point rise ever closer, and then of a sudden a shadow fell athwart him, and a well-bred remembered voice spoke with crisp clarity. "What are you about, sir? Explain yourself."
"You!" exclaimed Blood, craning with difficulty. "Avery, Ben, dear lad, stout comrade, you're in the nick of time. Quick, knock off the top of that devilish weed ere it rends me. Oh, my God, is that the Queen of Spades along o' ye? Nay, keep her at a distance and help me, old joy."
Avery keenly surveyed the spread-eagled colonel, the peering, twitching Solomon, the whole crazy set-up. He couldn't believe it.
"You mean that plant is growing at a rate of knots per hour?" he cried.
"'Tis the hellish maguey," chuckled Sheba spitefully, "a favourite house-plant of the savages, with which they decorate their porches. Change the bodies regular, and keep at an even temperature they last for years."
"Astonishing," murmured Avery, looking closer. "Why, such a plant presented to the Royal Society should win its donor sure election, mayhap a seat on the council."
"God, give me strength!" croaked Blood. "Cut me down first!"
"In good time, renegade." Avery was cold. "You may e'en dangle a while longer, deserter, what time ye explain your presence here, where I little looked for you."
"Who cares how he got here? We see how he shall speed hence," sneered Sheba, stroking the maguey and sticking out her tongue at the colonel. "Here's fitting end for pestilent cur, aye. His guts shall be in sweet uproar presently. Leave him, caro mio, and let's begone."
"Don't you dare!" bawled Blood. "Avery, if ye abandon me, ye abandon your lady vanity in her dire peril."
He craned some more and saw Avery for once stricken to the gills, and Sheba's eyes wide in fierce alarm.
"The savages have her. It's true, ye numps! If you don't believe me, ask the male model there."
Avery wheeled on Solomon, who leaped nervously and pawed his rags.
"Old Sol don't mean no harm," he whined. "Just a bit of gardening, crazy paving, edges clipped, moderate terms, and a 12-month guarantee. Old Sol don't know nothing about young women being sacrificed to the sun god, not I."
He cringed in Avery's grasp.
"You wouldn't have a piece of bread and drippin' about ye, mate. Oh, such as old Saul's mother made in Babbicum all these years gone by. all rare dripping it wore. There's some castaways, he whimpered, as crave cheese or rum wi' a curse, or burned almonds or Bellamy's pies, but dripping, dripping all a sizzle is the tack for old Saul.
Do you tell me, roared Avery in controlled fury, that some beastly pagans are about to sacrifice a woman? Speak, ancient. Is she blonde, English, upper class, and perfectly stacked? Oh, stop bellyaching, blood, I'm busy.
Did you have to use that form of words? Winced Blood. You won't let on as I told ye? Quavered Solomon. All right, then. Over yonder, past the pyramids, turn right, and keep barren left till you come to the plaza. You can't miss it. Noon kick-off, when the sun's rays strike the great altar of Cohacuguslin.
There was a whooshing noise, and Avery was gone with a speed that left the bushes shaking, followed by a despairing wail from Blood, a cry of, Stay, Barracuda! It's probably some other blonde from Sheba, and a prayer for Drippin' from Solomon Shafto. Along the jungle path stormed our hero, aware of brazen gongs booming and voices eerily chanting somewhere ahead, then of a packed throng of Indians through which he ploughed like Popeye on spinach. He marked not the great step pyramids, the barbaric carvings, the thousands thronging the plaza, the princess of the sun flaked out in her golden litter on the temple steps, or the pictogram scoreboard giving the order of service. Only one thing filled his view, a shapely form in maroon velvet bound on a huge marble slab, a fair head lolling, and above it a gleaming quartz blade in the sinewy hand of a feathered and painted priest. The sun's rays smote the marble, turning the fair head to burnished light. A huge gong clanged, the blade swept down in a glittering arc, and the executioner's wrist was clamped in a grip of steel, the blade an inch from the snowy bosom. Vanity shrieked, the executioner cried, Ooh, core! Spectators gasped. Brasso, the cacique, reeled in horror at this sacrilege. Disappointed punters and outraged bookies rushed forward, and the Princess of the Sun stirred, muttering sleepily,
What time is it? Oh, Christ, what a trip! Somebody please fetch my head!
Vanity stared up, unable to believe her eyes. Could it be? Of course it could! Those clean-cut features, the confident teeth, the gray eyes respectively, ashine with mastery and tenderness. The stray lock of hair on the noble brow, the heroic shirt ruffles, barely disturbed as he flicked aside the executioner.
"Sorry I'm late, dearest," said Captain Avery.
With another flick he had burst the rawhide thongs that held her, and she was clinging to him, half a swoon, while the Cohacuguslins went spare. A thousand painted faces screamed hate. A thousand weapons were raised to plunge into this daring stranger who had violated their mysteries, when a faint moaning sigh checked their mad rush, and Brasso, the cacique, flung his arms aloft with a shout of, Stay! Hold the phone! The princess speaks! Every eye turned towards the gold litter. Sure enough, the Princess of the Sun, blinking feebly, had come up on one elbow. She passed a limp hand over her queenly brow, stared vaguely towards the altar, made a limp but imperious sign, and subsided again, murmuring,
Oh, brother!
As one man, that huge throng of thousands stopped, turned towards the stone of sacrifice, and obediently prostrated themselves, beating their palms on the ground with sonorous groans. Vanity, gripped in Avery's muscular arm, shivered in dread, her blue eyes wide as she viewed the groveling mob.
"Ben, darling," she quavered, "oh, my sweet, you have saved me. Where the hell have you been? And, oh, why are they lying on the ground like that, as though in worship of us?"
Avery's glance swept fearlessly over the prone heaps about the altar, but his brow was knit. Truth to tell, he had half expected some protest at his cavalier interruption of the ceremony. Now his keen mind pierced the mystery. "Not us, sweetheart," he replied. "After all, they were sacrificing you. Nay, I must conclude they are worshipping me." He shrugged imperceptibly. "After all, why not? Such poor heathen have probably never seen a white man before."
"They saw curdled blood," said Vanity.
"That's not quite the same thing, is it?" said Avery, and his flashing eyes scanned the worshipping multitude again, and stopped at the temple steps, where Brasso was in earnest conversation with a red-skinned beauty in feathered conga skirt and exotic accessories. Reclining in a golden litter and staring in his direction with slightly glazed and rolling eyes, their primitive grunting speech meant nothing to the captain.
"But, princess, has he got wheels?"
Brasso was insisting. "You show me, 'cause I don't see him. So how can he be the great white god? Like, I mean, your word is law, but—" The princess moaned softly and focused unsteadily on the incredibly magnificent specimen who stood by the altar, all heroic disdain from his chin-dimple to kneecap. "Wow," thought the princess, her befuddled senses more aswim than ever. "That's better than drinking chocolate."
"Who needs wheels?" she murmured vibrantly. "Keep on worshipping he, great white god. I have spoken."
"That's what the lady says," sighed Brasso. "Oh, man. Okay, daughter of the sun, okay. But you're gonna have to marry that dude, you know that, don't you? I mean, like, we got a prophecy to fulfill, so, princess baby, you better get it right, or the sun god in his wrath is gonna bust your can, you know. You read me, princess?" Oh, hell, she's passed out again. "Okay, Potzelkittlin, get her back in the Holy of Holies, and somebody find the old honky Shafto and tell him to get his butt over here. This new cat may be the great white god, but I'll bet he don't speak Kohako-Guzlilnian worth a damn." Thus it was that as Avery and Vanity stood in each other's arms by the altar, surrounded by prostrate, adoring bodies, and wondered what this might portend, a squad of Indians descended on the clearing where blood still hung spread-eagled, calculating miserably that the Magway had about 6 inches to go, and scooped up Solomon Shafto, whom they dragged to the plaza. But of Black Sheba they saw no sign. Not surprisingly, since she had slithered into the tall timber at sound of their approach, and crouched there, hot-eyed and gnashing, as she wondered what had befallen Avery in his impetuous folly. Well, we know. What next, huh? What will Vanity say when she learns that her beloved is slated to take the isle with the Princess of the Sun? Will it be any louder than Blood's comments when the Magway starts to blossom? Is a craving for bread and dripping to be compared to a mainline addiction to drinking chocolate? Let's wait until nightfall, and then sneak closer past the deserted step pyramids in the ghostly moonlight until we find a convenient spot to eavesdrop.